Join me March 12th for a free event, Menopause Reset, a 3-day challenge to help you kickstart your metabolism so you can lose weight, sleep better, stop the hot flashes, and regain your energy. If you're a midlife woman who has thought about implementing lifestyle changes to help stop the hot flashes, sleep better, and lose those extra pounds, listen up. If you're ready to get your life back, but you're worried about how much time it takes, how you're going to get your family on board, or you just don't know where to start, I have a strategy that is exactly what you need to help you get off the weight loss, sleep deprivation, hot flash having roller coaster. Head over to hellohotflash.com/challenge to get your limited free spot. The Menopause Reset 3-day challenge includes nightly live coaching. We start March 12th, so sign up at hellohotflash.com/challenge. See you March 12th. Hey there, I'm Stephanie Shaw. Welcome to the Hello Hot Flash podcast, where midlife women can learn from guest experts and authors who discuss menopause and all that comes with this new chapter in our lives. Hello Hot Flash, where we learn to control the change and not let the change control us. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Hello Hot Flash, where we help you control the midlife change. I'm excited to be here today with our guest, Dr. Mindy Goldman. Mindy, thank you so much for being here with us today.
I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yeah. You guys, you know that I like to do some investigative work and listen to folks. And I'll listen to, when I'm interviewing someone, I'll listen to their episodes or other podcasts they've been on. I've been purging your information. I've been going deep, deep, deep. I'm like, oh, wow, I wish I would have known this. And oh, wow, I want to make sure that the audience hears it. So you guys are definitely in for a treat today. I'm Mindy Goldman. Again, Mindy is the Chief Clinical Officer for Midi Health and the Clinical Professor Emeritus and current Director of the Gynecology Center for Cancer Survivors and At-Risk Women at UCSF. So again, I so appreciate you being here. Before we got on, we were talking a little bit about, I was telling you about my journey, and you were like, that's the story of all of us. We're all living that story. So can you start the conversation by telling us a little bit about why you have this focus and this passion to help women in midlife?
Sure, I am. I'm happy to. So I am as you had mentioned, I'm an OBGYN. I have worked at UCSF for most of my career before jumping to join Midi Health. Early on in my career, I had just finished my training a few years prior. Mm-hmm. My dearest friend got breast cancer at a really early age, and I helped take care of her with her two appointments. And she had a really aggressive cancer and ended up passing away in a year and a half. Mm-hmm. I ended up co-founding a nonprofit in her memory that provided provided funding for complementary and integrative therapies to improve quality of life. And I came back, I had taken time off to help her, and she died at home with her family, and I was there. When I came back to UCSF, I had this aha that I wanted to do more for cancer survivors. And this was in the early 2000s. And our cancer center was actually looking for someone to come on board to help sort of follow people who had had cancer, were doing well, had symptoms like menopause, had been thrown into it from chemotherapy. And they were looking for someone to do follow-up. And all of a sudden, I came along. And I ended up joining the Cancer Center, working side by side with some of the oncologists and breast surgeons. And people would ask me a lot of women's health questions of, how do we manage menopause? Is it safe to get pregnant after breast cancer? What to do about bleeding on drugs like tamoxifen? And I started looking in the literature and realizing, oh my gosh, there is nothing out there. And so fast forward these past 20 years, I feel very lucky to have worked helping sort of develop a field that bridges breast oncology and gynecology, focusing on the specific women's health issues that face cancer survivors. I've worked with the American College of OBGYN, helping write some of their guidelines. I currently work with the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, helping write protocols and guidelines for menopause and sexual functioning. And in doing that, a lot of what kept coming up over and over and over again is, so now I've had my cancer treatment, I'm doing okay, but I'm having all these side effects. And menopausal symptoms were like at the top of everyone's list. And so it's been really like so satisfying to be able to help develop this field and come up with, help women find treatment options that are effective so they don't hear what they've been hearing over and over again is be lucky, be thankful you're alive, just live with it, just deal with these symptoms. So that's sort of my journey. And I jumped ship fully from UCSF in order to join MIDI. And I supervise our clinical care, but also I'm going to be helping launch a national survivorship platform. So that's what I'm really excited about.
That sounds amazing. I can't wait until that happens. So you just mentioned how having cancer can trigger menopause symptoms, but I've also heard that menopause can also cause cancer. Like, is it a either or why am I hearing that?
Okay, well let's talk first about cancer and menopause symptoms. One of the main reasons that you can see, well, there's a number of reasons you can see menopause symptoms in cancer survivors. One is many cancer survivors get chemotherapy, and chemotherapy targets rapidly dividing cells like cancer cells, but it's not specific for only the cancer cells. And the cells within the ovary are affected by chemotherapy, and so ovarian function stops. It's not necessarily permanent. It depends on how much chemotherapy someone gets and the age of the patient. So they may have return of ovarian function, but many times when people are getting chemotherapy, their ovaries will stop functioning and they will have menopause side effects. Also, there are some cancer survivors who, as part of their treatment, removing their ovaries may be recommended. So they may have surgical menopause. That may be in some breast cancer patients. That may be in gynecology cancer patients. And so, with the onset of surgical menopause, people can have pretty severe symptoms. Then there are some medications, some of the hormonal therapies that are used to treat breast cancer, like tamoxifen or the aromatase inhibitors, that sometimes can cause hot flashes as a side effect of the drugs. So there's a number of reasons why you can see menopausal symptoms in cancer survivors. I don't think that we have good data that says menopause and menopause itself causes cancer. What we do know is the rates of many cancers, or most cancers, we don't know why people get, whether it's a combination of genetic or inherent susceptibility and environmental factors. We know that the risk of cancer goes up as we age. You know, if you look at lifetime risks of breast cancer, the lifetime risk is 1 in 8 women will have had breast cancer if women live to be 85. And so that risk keeps going up. So menopause, women are getting older. It's not clear that just stopping hormonal function makes them more susceptible, but you start seeing cancers as women get into this age group. And in fact, the most common time of diagnosis is actually in the 50s.
So it may not be that the menopause is causing cancer. It's the idea or the fact that we're just aging and both are happening at the same time. And sometimes
Exactly.
people put the, okay. All right. That's really, really good to know because you will read that, you know, during menopause, you're more susceptible to have cancer and so forth. But it's just the fact that you're aging, which in turn could cause.
Yeah, I think it may be more complicated. We know that the drop in hormones that occurs with menopause is associated with a higher risk of disease. So we know that estrogen impacts our heart, and that estrogen is protective of heart disease. And you start seeing heart disease go up after menopause. Heart disease is actually the number one cause of death. We know that the risk of diabetes goes up after menopause. So we know that hormones impact metabolic health. There are studies that talk about whether cancers are related to our inherent metabolic health and whether there's higher risks of certain cancers in association with other diseases like diabetes. So the question isn't, it's not that simple,
Yeah.
but I don't think that we have good evidence that just going into menopause in and of itself is a risk factor for cancer.
Good. I love the way that you summed that up. That's perfect. So we also hear a lot about hormone therapy, and that's a big question that I get from folks. Should I take HRT? What is HRT? Can you answer the question, what again is hormone therapy, and who should or who should not take hormone therapy?
Okay, how much time do you have?
I have
This
hours.
is a big
I love this kind of stuff.
this is a big question, and I'm really glad you asked that. Hormone therapy, or HRT, stands for hormone replacement therapy. The new terminology is actually MHT, or menopause hormone therapy. But the why they labeled that as such is that you are replacing the body with the hormones that decline after menopause. So after menopause, the ovaries no longer produce estrogen and progesterone. And hormone therapy is a combination of either estrogen alone or estrogen and progesterone. In general, estrogen is the component of hormones that treats the symptoms, and progesterone is the hormonal component that protects the uterus from uterine cancer. If you don't have a uterus, so you've had a hysterectomy and you have symptoms and you go on to hormone therapy, typically you will take estrogen only. No uterus, no need for progesterone. So that's sort of what hormone therapy is. There's a lot of controversy about should all women take hormones? Let's kind of do a deep dive going back in history. If you go back to the 1990s and even before that, when women went through menopause, there was more of a push to give them hormones with the thought that hormones prevent heart disease, which is the number one cause of death. So hormones were typically recommended regardless if people had symptoms, and particularly if they had risk factors for heart disease. They were smokers, they were obese, they had diabetes, they had hypertension or family history of heart disease. Then in the late 1990s, were the first well-designed studies. These were called the HERS trials, that looked at high-risk women who had already had a heart attack. They had some sort of cardiac event to see if they gave them hormones, did it prevent a secondary cardiac event? And lo and behold, they found it did not. And people said, well, that's sort of interesting, but you want to look at healthy menopausal women who don't have heart disease to see if you give them hormones, does it help prevent heart disease? And that was the design of a very large trial called the Women's Health Initiative that has impacted medicine and how the public perceives hormones to this day. And I will say from the start, impacted it in a very negative way. It has impacted why women don't get the treatment that they need and why more women suffer during menopause. That being said, it was one of the, it's the largest preventive studies sponsored by the NIH. Gold standard, well-designed trial. The trial was designed to look at heart disease as an outcome. It was not designed to see, do hormones treat symptoms? So there were two groups of people studied in that study, women who had a uterus and women who had had a hysterectomy. So if they had a uterus, they got estrogen with progesterone in the form of a certain hormone pill. And if they had no uterus, they got estrogen alone in the form of a hormone pill. And there was a lot of bad publicity in 2002 when the estrogen progesterone arm of the study was stopped short with the finding it didn't protect against heart disease and it surpassed the threshold for breast cancer. The press totally took off with the results, and it was as if for the first time women were hearing, is hormones have any impact about breast cancer, which I'm going to talk about. But it made it seem like hormones were awful. Everyone's calling, get me off these things. They must cause cancer. Some of the things about that study, because it was designed to look at heart disease, it looked at an older age population. The average age was 63, but the average age of menopause is 51. And most women in coming in talking about hormones are in their 40s and 50s and not in their 60s. And in the women in that study who were within 10 years of menopause or under the age of 60, hormones actually did prevent against heart disease and were associated with a lower risk of dying. And there's now what's called the timing hypothesis, which says if you start women earlier, within 10 years of menopause or under age 60. Not only does it treat symptoms, but it protects against heart disease, which is the number one cause of death. So that's one thing. We've also learned a lot about different formulations of hormones since then. And we've learned that, yeah, because in that trial, they found not just in the estrogen progesterone arm, it was stopped because of a higher risk of breast cancer. In the estrogen arm, they found a higher risk of stroke. And we have found since then that if you do other formulations that aren't oral, like a patch,
Right.
that avoids first pass metabolism through the liver, and it affects liver clotting profiles less. And we think that patches aren't even associated with a higher risk of stroke at all.
Wow.
So no higher risk of blood clots, no higher risk of stroke. So we've learned a lot about different types. We've also learned about breast cancer. And there's been a nice publication in JAMA, one of the premier medical journals, published in 2020 that looked at 18-year follow-up from the Women's Health Initiative, looking at breast cancer outcomes. And when the Women's Health Initiative was stopped back in 2002, estrogen progesterone arm had seen a higher risk of breast cancer. The estrogen-only arm for women who had a hysterectomy actually saw a lower risk of breast cancer, but that wasn't publicized. But people wondered what was going to happen when you followed these people further on. And that was published in 2020. And what they found was the estrogen progesterone group compared to placebo, even 18 years out, had had a higher risk of breast cancer compared to the placebo group, no difference in dying of breast cancer. The most fascinating thing was that the estrogen-only group compared to placebo, 18 years out, had a statistically lower risk of getting breast cancer and statistically lower risk of dying of breast cancer. So what that tells us is it's not the estrogen component, but the progesterone component that may have negative effects on the breast. And nowadays, we use different types of progesterone than was used in the Women's Health Initiative. In those days, they used a very strong type of progesterone that bound to the receptor very tightly. We now use more natural, what are called bioidentical formulations, which I'm happy to talk about. And there are some studies that suggest the bioidentical formulations may not have negative effects on the breast at all. So we know a lot more about hormones now than we did 20 years ago. We have many formulations that are much safer. We know that they're very effective and the most effective treatment for symptoms of menopause. And we also know if they're started soon around the time of menopause, that they protect against the most common cause of death, heart disease. They also protect against bone loss. And studies are a little bit mixed, but suggest if they are started early, may also have cognitive protection. But I think because of all the sort of fallout from the Women's Health Initiative, everyone fears hormones cause breast cancer. They're awful. And there's both the public perceives that as well as people in medicine. And we have now physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs and health practitioners, clinicians who aren't getting menopause training. So they don't really know the deep dive into the true risks and benefits of hormones. And not everyone can take hormones. You know, if you've had hormone positive breast cancer, it's considered a contraindication to take hormones. And even though patches don't increase the risk of blood clots, there are certain conditions, like if you've had a prior stroke, that we don't recommend taking hormones. So there are still health risks where we won't recommend it. But for the vast majority of women going through menopause, hormones are a very effective treatment of their symptoms so they don't have to suffer, and they can also help prevent disease.
Yeah, I love that. I love what you're saying because it's informing us at another level and making us start to think about what the research really said and what the outcomes really are. Because a lot of times the PR hype behind something can get us so confused and cause fear when it's actually something that could actually support us. You mentioned bioidentical hormones. So
Yes.
talk a little bit about bioidentical hormones versus like compound formulations.
I am happy to talk about that because I think that there is a lot of confusion in people's minds about what's bioidentical and what's compounded. So, compounded formulations are hormones that oftentimes contain different formulations of estrogen, progesterone that are made in specialized compounding pharmacies. They often use non-standardized formulations like injectables or troches or different formulations that are commercially available. They are touted as being safer because they're made naturally, typically, and there are providers who will adjust the dose based on lab values and salivary hormone testing and people's individual makeup. And we don't have clear, good, randomized control trial evidence that says compounded formulations truly are safer. And in fact, sometimes compounded formulations, when they give progesterone, which, as I mentioned, is used to protect against uterine cancer, they sometimes use it in a topical cream formulation. And it turns out creams of progesterone are not absorbed well through the skin and don't give high enough levels for uterine protection. And I have diagnosed a patient with uterine cancer who was on a compounded formulation where she was not getting sufficient progesterone for uterine protection. Bioidentical formulations are formulations or hormones that are chemically similar in structure to the hormones that are produced by our body. There are many commercially available forms of bioidentical hormones that are covered by health insurance. One of the things at MIDI is we are providing care that's covered by health insurance. When we prescribe medications, we try to make sure people aren't having to pay out of pocket. When you go and get a compounded formulation, these are not covered by insurance, and women are paying huge amounts of money, not realizing that they can get bioidentical natural formulations that will be covered by their insurance. The large guiding organizations in the US, like the American Endocrine Society, the Menopause Society, have position statements that say regarding compounded formulations, until we have randomized control trial data that really say they are safer, that people should assume that hormones are hormones or hormones, meaning the risks and benefits are similar. And people shouldn't be jumping to that just because they are being advertised as such. Now, that being said, if I have someone who's on it and they are getting sufficient uterine protection, they're doing well, that's great. Again, I try to have everything be cost beneficial for my patients. So I try to, if they're open to it, get them on a standard bioidentical formulation that their insurance will cover. But if they're doing well and that's what they want and they are getting sufficient uterine protection, I'm fine with that.
So you mentioned something. I heard you say this before, on another interview I was listening. Troche, what is that?
So there's different formulations where there are oral formulations where people can get absorption. There are also like pellets that people get injected and they can get formulations of hormones. So both of those are formulations where they get sort of slow absorption over time into the body of the hormones.
Okay, I didn't even know that that was going to be a perfect transition to my next question because I'd heard that how you take HRT is different for every woman. So talk to us a little bit about that. Should we take an oral HRT or should we use a patch or should we use cream? What's the difference and how do we have that conversation with our medical professional?
So let me just step back first about should you use HRT? Despite the fact that I mentioned that hormones, if started early, have significant health benefits, the large guiding organizations in this country still have statements that say hormones should be used for treating symptoms and not preventing disease. They'll say, oh, yeah, by the way, if you start them early, it will prevent heart disease, but that's not the prime reason you should be using hormones. I think when you spend enough time talking to perimenopausal and menopausal women, then almost everyone has some sort of symptoms. They may not even realize. I think you told me this, that you went through this. People may not realize that it has to do with hormonal dysfunction, hair thinning, hair loss, joint pain, dry mouth, palpitations. These are some of the atypical symptoms. I think women know about the hot flashes, the mood changes, vaginal dryness, sexual dysfunction, but some of the unusual ones they may not be as aware of. And so I do think the vast majority of women have some sort of symptoms such that hormones are a reasonable option for most women in the perimenopause and menopause. You need to individualize when you are providing any sort of treatment. For example, women who have eczema or skin conditions may have reactions to transdermal patches. So in general, we like, and many of the large guiding organizations will say, consider something like a patch first-line therapy because you avoid first-pass metabolism through the liver, and so that's going to be lower risk for clots. But there are some people that may have skin reactions. About 10% of people end up having skin reactions and don't tolerate the patch. An oral formulation may be perfectly reasonable for them. If someone has a health condition where they have a higher risk of clot, some health conditions where the risk of clot is really high, we don't recommend hormones, period.
Okay.
But there may be others where it's sort of this gray zone. And we would say in those situations, look, we want you on a transdermal because we, based on the best data, this was a large trial called the ESTER study. Mm-hmm. We know that transdermals are not thought to increase the risk of clots. Now, let's say you have, in addition to your hot flashes, one of your symptoms is vaginal dryness and you have pain with penetration.
Mm-hmm.
We know that vaginal hormones target the tissue of concern. They stay locally with minimal to, if anything, absorbed into their blood, into the bloodstream. So they are safer even for people who may have reasons or contraindications to taking systemic hormones. Mm-hmm. Many can take vaginal hormones. So we may target you and say, okay, we're going to treat your hot flashes with one type, and then we're going to recommend a certain type for the vagina. And that may be a ring, a suppository, a cream. So everything should be individualized based on someone's own personal health history, their desires, and the symptoms, you know, that they are telling us.
That's really important to know. And I would have never thought about taking it orally, but also using it as a vaginal insert. I thought you, if you took it orally, it kind of covered everything for you, or it may perhaps not be safe to do it
both ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have that question. For some people, when you give it orally,
uh-huh.
or via a patch, what we call systemically, where it gets into the bloodstream, it may be sufficient to treat vaginal symptoms, but for many people, it's not.
Yeah.
So there are plenty of people who end up needing to be on both,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think now we have, if you're talking of birth control that we use sometimes in the perimenopause instead of HRT, we have so many different formulations now. We've got vaginal rings and we've got patches and we've got oral formulations with different types of estrogen and progesterones. And even with HRT, we have all different doses. We have topical gels that can be used for people who have reactions to the patch but can't take an oral, for people who can't tolerate oral progesterone for uterine protection. We have vaginal formulations. So there are studies now showing that using the pills you take orally in the vagina gives high levels in the uterus and provides uterine protection. We
wow.
also have progesterone IUDs that can be used. They're typically used for contraception, but they can be used off-label to provide uterine protection as part of someone's HRT. So we really, really individualize based on someone's own history, desires, and needs based on what their symptoms are.
Join me March 12th for a free event, Menopause Reset, a 3-day challenge to help you kickstart your metabolism so you can lose weight, sleep better, stop the hot flashes, and regain your energy. Head over to hellohotflash.com/challenge to get your free limited spot. The Menopause Reset 3-day challenge includes nightly live coaching, and we start March 12th. Sign up at hellohotflash.com/challenge. See you March 12th. So we've talked about estrogen and progesterone and I think we've mentioned cortisol, but we haven't talked about testosterone. And a lot of women don't associate testosterone as a female hormone that needs to be protected. Talk to us about testosterone and should women be taking any testosterone supplements or medication?
Okay, so first of all, it's important to realize that as women, we do have testosterone in our bodies. Our ovaries and adrenals produce male hormones. Our adrenal glands produces the DHEA, which is a precursor to testosterone. There are many complicated reactions that go on in the body. There are enzymes convert one substance to another substance, and in our bodies, there is an enzyme called aromatase that converts male hormones that all women have into weak forms of estrogen. And so those reactions are going on all the time. And in fact, in the breast cancer world, one of the treatments that they use are called aromatase inhibitors. And they shut down that reaction and they shut down all peripheral estrogen production in the body. And that's how they act as a breast cancer drug, but they can cause a lot of side effects because our body is very sensitive to even low levels of estrogen. So I tell you all of this just to say it is very complicated, but women do produce male hormones. Testosterone, when used as a supplement after menopause, is a little bit more controversial. I think we have better data in terms of giving testosterone for things like bone health and muscle mass in men. There are people that believe in women it should be used for bone health, for muscle mass, for improving fatigue, for improving metabolic health, for improving cognition and overall health. The best data that we actually have is for improving sexual functioning and specifically low libido in postmenopausal women. So there was a large expert consensus group that got together to look at the data for testosterone in women and really summarized it well, saying that's really where the best indication is. So if you have someone who you're treating their menopausal symptoms, they're doing well, but they end up having low libido, it is a reasonable thing to offer them testosterone. Now, testosterone is not FDA approved for women. Actually, the history behind it is there were some well-designed studies, and there was a company making a nice patch of testosterone that was being looked at for treating menopausal women who were already on HRT. So they had their symptoms treated, well estrogenized, and they found improvements in sexual functioning. And it never got through the FDA because those studies came out and that was presented after on the heels of the Women's Health Initiative. And the FDA said, we're not approving anything hormonal until you give us more safety data with regards to the breast. And to this day, it's never been FDA approved. In other countries, like in Australia, you can get these testosterone patches. Here, the only way that women can use testosterone is either using a small percentage, usually one tenth of a male formulation, or by going to a compounding pharmacy. So, I already just talked about compounded formulations and why there's some controversy about that. And now I'm telling you that's one of the only ways to really get testosterone. So, if you are using a compounding pharmacy, you have to make sure that they source their prescriptions well. We usually find out whether they do third-party testing and whether they are certified. But compounded testosterone can be made into low doses where women are not going to get male hormone side effects and has been shown to improve sexual functioning. Now, in premenopausal women, we actually have a couple FDA-approved drugs. One is called flibanserin, the trade name is Addy. The other is called bralimonotide, the trade name is Vyleesi. They are FDA-approved for low libido or hypoactive sexual desire disorder in premenopausal women, not in postmenopausal women. At least with flibanserin, the studies have shown it's as effective, but it has to be used off-label. So, a little bit more controversial. Like, to answer your question, it's not clear to me that all women taking HRT need to be on testosterone. I think there are a subset of women, particularly women with low libido, who do not find that just being on HRT alone is sufficient, that they can benefit from testosterone. Because it is a controlled, it is considered a controlled substance, DEA regulations are changing. It is a lot more difficult to get that, but I think we do have good evidence that it is beneficial in that situation. I don't think we have the evidence for all the other things that we have talked about, but hopefully we're going to see studies because maybe we will find that women should be using it for cognition or sleep or fatigue or metabolic health.
Yeah, I'm listening to you and debating in my brain if I should actually say this, but I'm going to say it. So we had the study to make sure that women could have testosterone so that their libido would be increased, but we didn't care to have a study to make sure that their cognition and that their bone health was taken care of. So as long as you're still doing what you're supposed to do, who cares about the rest?
No, I hear you. I think that where those studies came about is we have long known that some of sexual female sexual functioning is related to male hormones. So I think there was a lot of interest in looking at supplemental testosterone as a way to improve sexual functioning. And so I think that's why those studies originally came out. I would argue with you that, you know, when you look at sexual functioning, we have Viagra for men. There are studies where it can be used for women, but we've had things for men and women's sex lives were totally ignored for
Yeah,
years. You
that's
know,
true too.
finally, we have some drugs now. I think the issue around testosterone is just, and normally to achieve some of those results like bone health and muscle mass, you need really high doses, and that can be dangerous for women. If you cause androgenizing side effects,
Right.
like symptoms like acne and hair growth, maybe those are the doses you need to be able to achieve some of those effects, but that could potentially be dangerous for women. So I think this is kind of like the first part we know where there's good evidence to support its use for sexual functioning. I don't think we have enough studies to say, are these tiny doses that we know help out with sexual functioning really sufficient to help out with other health-related things like muscle mass, cognition, and all of that?
Mindy, thanks for talking me off the ledge. I'm like, what? They'll research that, won't they? Which, you know, in my mind, I'm making a generalization that all the researchers are men. So I know you guys, I went way off.
Well, I think it's a really good question. I mean, if you look back, traditionally, most of the research has been in men, and they take those results and see, can we just correlate it to women? You know, finally, over the past 20 plus years, we're starting to see good quality research being done in women, but there's still plenty of areas where we need to improve on that. You cannot take results from men and assume they're going to correlate in exactly the same way for women.
Yeah, that's so true. So you mentioned this a little bit, and is there anything that we can do around the lack of training for medical professionals as it relates to menopause? Is it how can our voice be heard? I think it's happening because people are talking about menopause like crazy now. It's everywhere. You know, the stars are talking about it and people are creating products. But me as a layperson, what can I do?
I think what you're doing is great. You are educating people by having this podcast. And I do think it's changing. I think the press is finally picking up on it. I think by doing podcasts like you are, raising awareness, making people aware, it's not just symptoms. There are health-related impacts of menopause. And in treating the symptoms, you may also have beneficial effects on your future health. And so I think making women more aware of that, having those women seek out care, whether it's from their own providers, their own clinicians, and asking them, what do you think? Can I have treatment? Should I have treatment? Or seeking out places like MIDI. We established this to really reach women nationally with care that's covered by insurance so that people don't have to be like questioning this. The Menopause Society has certified practitioners throughout the country that have had additional certification in menopause. So there are in-person places that people can go. So I think things are slowly changing. residency programs need to change. You
Mm-hmm.
know, about only a third of residency programs in OBGYN, which is usually you're going to think, I'm going to go see my OB-GYN to talk about this, but only about a third get training in menopause. And even of those, many times the menopause training is a short 6-week rotation, you know? So I think that by raising more awareness publicly, it's also putting pressure on the medical system to say, look, the Women's Health Initiative was one thing. There's been a huge fallout from it. Women aren't getting the treatment they need. They're suffering from symptoms, and those symptoms also may impact other health risks in the future. One we didn't even talk about. I reviewed an article not too long ago that suggested women who have more hot flashes may have more white matter hyperintensities in their brain that may be associated with vascular disease and impact future things like stroke and dementia. So we think of hot flashes as these mild annoyance. We don't know. Maybe there's actually negative health impacts. Maybe having hot flashes that aren't treated will cause a higher risk of dementia. Certainly, we need future studies and more in-depth studies to understand that. But to me, it really highlights, don't suffer. Don't let anyone tell you this is a normal part of aging. If you are having symptoms, get the treatment that you need. If you have health conditions that you can't or shouldn't take hormones, seek out expert care to make sure you are getting, because we haven't even touched on, but I would tell you, and you know, in my area of expertise in cancer survivors, there's a whole slew of other options that people, besides hormones, that people can use to alleviate their symptoms. And the biggest thing I tell patients day after day is, do not let anyone tell you you just have to suffer.
So, Mindy, if you have a couple more minutes, can you go down that cancer path? I have a very close relative who is going through breast cancer right now. Any additional comments, information that you can provide, I would love to be able to make sure that she's aware of that and any of the other listeners who may be going through the same thing.
Sure, I love talking about that. There are a number of prescription medications that can be used to treat hot flashes in people who can't or shouldn't take hormones. There are randomized control trials that have shown benefits of low doses of some of the antidepressants, neuropathic pain relievers, anti-seizure medicines, an older study with a blood pressure medicine, overactive bladder medicines that have all been found to help out with hot flashes, night sweats. The only thing those diverse drugs have in common is that they cross the blood-brain barrier, and we know that there is a temperature regulation zone within the brain. Interestingly, for many of those drugs, the doses that are used for hot flashes are lower than what the doses for what the drug is typically used for, so oftentimes they have less side effects. Through the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, we actually put out guidelines on specific drugs, dose that's used, notes about it. Just this year in May, a new drug got FDA approval. It was even advertised in the Super Bowl. Like, who would think that in the Super Bowl you're going to advertise about a hot flash drug? This drug is called Veozah, and it is the first drug that targets the specific area within the hypothalamus of the brain where that temperature regulation zone is. So it affects what's called the KNDy neurons, and we now understand that estrogen effects on that area where the KNDy neurons are is how hot flashes occur. So this is targeting the exact area within the brain where temperature regulation occurs. When that drug got FDA approval, they actually excluded breast cancer patients in the trials because they thought it would be easier to get through the FDA. But there's nothing about it. It is not hormonal, and there's nothing about it that makes it contraindicated in breast cancer survivors or other cancer survivors. And so people are very excited about that. The biggest issue is it's not yet on a lot of insurance plans, so sometimes we're having to fight to get coverage. I haven't had enough patients on it yet long term to see sort of the benefits, but the way I look at it is it's just another tool in the toolbox. There are many, many options, haven't even touched on lifestyle and integrative options. We have data with cognitive behavioral therapy for vasomotor symptoms, hypnosis. There are certain herbs and supplements like black cohosh, Siberian rhubarb, maca that can be beneficial. You want to make sure you're talking to someone who knows, like, is it safe to use if you've had certain health conditions like cancer? But there are many, many options that people should realize that are in the toolbox. And again, don't let anyone say, yep, sorry, because you can't take hormones, you just got to suffer. We also have other options for vaginal dryness and sexual dysfunction. So, whereas hormones aren't for everyone, plenty of other options that can be used. Really excited by this new drug, Veozah. Hopefully, there'll be other drugs coming down the line that will provide even more options.
That's wonderful to hear. I so appreciate your time, your information. If you notice, I'm like taking notes. I'm like, oh, need to go back and read about that and that. So I will put a lot of links in the show notes. I like to ask my guests, what are you reading or listening to right now?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, when I read things that have nothing to do with medicine because I live and breathe this all the time. I'm an avid reader of both books, news. I particularly, though, when I'm reading the news, I'm looking at health-related stories. I am looking at any publications, listening to any podcasts that are targeting women because I want to understand what my patients are hearing. I want to make sure I want to understand what's out there and what's giving people good information, but also are there things that people are coming in where they're saying things that are completely off the wall. So I don't have one particular, podcast, one particular resource that I go to, but I try to read a lot. I think the one thing that I would say to you as broadcasting out there for lots and lots of women is source what they are reading. If they are reading something and it's like, hey, I'm not sure, is that really true? Does that make sense? Bring it to someone, bring it hopefully to their provider where they can have a conversation. If their provider isn't equipped with the knowledge to have that conversation, seek someone out who does have that knowledge and expertise so that you're not doing something that's dangerous and you're potentially learning about things that could be helpful.
That's awesome. So, how can we find you? And tell us a little bit about MIDI as well.
Sure. So MIDI is a telehealth company that is focused in perimenopause and menopause. So sort of our target age range is women between the ages of 40 to 65. We do see younger women who have hormonal dysfunction with things like PCOS or premature ovarian insufficiency. We are very excited that we're now in all states. We have insurance coverage that is, we don't launch in a state till we get on at least 50% of the major insurers for that state. We have that in 16 of our states. And then when we partner with either a large health system or with company insurers that bring us into a state, we'll launch into other states. So because we're out there, people can find us by looking up joinmidi.com. We have more than 100 clinicians that are all experts in menopause. And like I said, we are covered by all the major insurance plans, and we provide care that cross covers both women's health and primary care. So we do weight management. We know that you can't provide management of menopause without understanding someone's metabolic health and without understanding what other health issues are going on. We're not trying to take people from their providers and their clinicians. We work with other clinicians in people's communities. We refer when they need in-person evaluations. You can't do everything over telehealth, but we're able to manage many, many symptoms. So I'm excited by that. Like I said, we are offering specialty care like weight management. We know that that's a big, big issue for many women when they approach menopause. We see average of at least 5 pound weight gain. We know that's associated with higher risks like diabetes. So that's a big component of what we're doing. I'm excited to now launch more specialty visits in the cancer survivorship space as well.
And I like the fact that you guys have a naturopath that works with you as well.
Yeah. One of the things I work in developing a lot of our protocols that we then send out to experts for feedback. And what I'm really proud of is, for example, in our protocols for how to manage women with symptomatic hot flashes and night sweats, we have all evidence-based guidelines with references for the use of hormones. We have evidence-based guidelines with references for the use of all these other drugs like Veozah and these other drugs. And in the same document, we have evidence-based use of integrative therapies, herbs, and botanicals based on the expertise of having our naturopath. So we provide very holistic care that I am really proud of, because many times, even for people who do want standard HRT, there are many lifestyle things. We lean very heavy into lifestyle, and there are many lifestyle or integrative options that we may recommend as a supplement to improve symptoms or health with various diseases even further.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm so happy that you women are out there doing what you are doing. This is the second time I've had someone from MIDI on the podcast. I learned so much. I know that my audience will learn a lot as well. And again, thank you so much for what you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me. I love that you're doing this and making women aware of perimenopause and menopause, and that there are treatment options out there. So thank you for inviting me to be here.
Of course, of course. Everyone, thank you once again for listening to Hello Hot Flash, where we help you control the midlife change. Make sure to check out the show notes, where we will include links to the subjects that we covered today and links to any books or anything that we've mentioned as well. Make it a great day, and here's to your health. If you're a midlife woman who has thought about implementing lifestyle changes to help stop the hot flashes, sleep better, and lose those extra pounds, well, listen up. If you're ready to get your life back, but you're worried about how much time it takes, how you're going to get your family on board, or you just don't know where to start, I have a strategy that is exactly what you need to help you get off the weight loss, sleep deprivation, hot flash having roller coaster. Join me March 12th for a free event, Menopause Reset, a 3-day challenge to help you kickstart your metabolism so you can lose weight, sleep better, stop the hot flashes, and regain your energy. Head over to hellohotflash.com/challenge to get your limited free spot. The Menopause Reset 3-day challenge includes nightly live coaching. We start March 12th, so sign up at hellohotflash.com/challenge. See you March 12th.